Please be seated.
Court is ready now to hear argument in 080316, Methodist Healthcare System versus Emmeline Rankin.
Court, Mr. Cooper will present argument for the petitioner. Have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I almost feel like my case has already been argued once this morning, but I will go ahead and try to cover some of the points that were not addressed in the earlier argument. Now, the issue here is whether or not the statute of repose violates the open courts provision. And as a preliminary matter, I think one of the things that I'm sure this court is aware is that the open courts challenges that have been made in the past create a certain tension between this court and the legislature. This court, as well as the legislature, each have functions to do. And one of the functions, obviously, of the legislature is to modify the law, including common law remedies, in order to affect public policy. Now, this court, in order to address the tension, that's T-E-N-S-I-O-N, between the open courts provision and the legislature, has adopted several, I think, rules or accommodations. One is that as we start with a statute, we presume that it's constitutional. And the second one, and this court recently did this, said this in Owens Corning versus Carroll, is that it's within the authority of the legislature to make reasoned adjustments to the legal system in order to affect public policy. All of this then comes into the test, which this court has adopted most recently 2 years ago in Yancey, regarding whether or not a statute will survive an open courts challenge or will not. And it's not whether or not necessarily it impinges upon somebody's rights or doesn't.
How does this statute survive?
This statute survives the open courts challenge because it is not arbitrary and it is not unreasonable when balanced against the statute's purposes and basis.
Does that have to do with the length of time? I mean, would it be different if it was a 2 year and 1 month statute of repose?
I think that goes into it, Your Honor, because this court, and what I tried to do, and let me say, I think I've read every single open courts cases that's been decided in the last 100 years by this court, and they are mind-boggling, to say the least, but there are certain factors, particularly in the last 30 years, that this court has looked at in order to determine whether or not the legislative action is arbitrary or unreasonable. Now, the first one is whether or not the remedy, whether or not the change is directly related to a crisis identified by the legislature, and the change bears a relationship to the articulated legislative goals. For example, in the Owens Corning case, this court identified there was a problem that the legislature had saw, and that is plaintiffs from other states whose causes of actions were barred by the statute of limitations were coming into Texas to try to use our courts and our systems to affect causes of action that were otherwise barred in their own states.
What's the problem here? Isn't the problem allegedly insurance rates and insurance crisis?
Sure. If you look at the legislative history, in fact, if you go to the amicus brief by the hospitals on page 10, it talks about a study, the Nelson study, that was made before, ordered by Senator Ratliff, before the 2003 session.
So we believe that insurance crisis continues forever?
Well, I think the issue is what existed at the time the legislature made their decision. Because obviously, one of the things, Your Honor, one of the purposes in adopting the statute was to try to eliminate the crisis.
We should there be
so it should it, hopefully it would eliminate part of the crisis.
Well, let's say it has. Should there be evidence to show that the so-called insurance crisis is now over, and therefore they can attack? Can the statute be attacked on that basis?
Well, I don't believe it can, Your Honor. The question is whether or not there was this legitimate basis
at the time of the statute.
At the time it was passed, because it's almost, it puts the legislature almost in a catch-22 position. If it doesn't work, then you say, well, there's no real relation. If it does work, then you're saying, well, there's no we don't need it now. And I think if you look at all the court's prior cases involving open courts, we've gone back to the time that the legislature passed, for example, in the Owens Corning case. We look back at the condition that existed. In the LeBone case versus City of Galveston, it's just the opposite. They look back and said there was no legislative goal, there was no problem being addressed when they totally abolished all liability for any premises defects. And the court said because there was not this relationship.
Well, let's look at the elements of an open courts violation. The restriction can't be unreasonable or arbitrary.
Correct.
Now, I don't think arbitrary is really what applies here. To me, arbitrary would be if they just said we're not going to allow any cancer cases or any particular type of case. So let's just look at unreasonable, okay? Unreasonable when balanced against the statute's purpose and basis. And the purpose of a statute of repose is to get rid of stale claims because witnesses have died, memories fade, proof is difficult, and that's just not fair. But in a res ipsa case, when there's no question as to liability, then why wouldn't you measure reasonableness against that type of claim?
Well, first off, I disagree with the assumption you just made. The sole purpose of the statute of repose, according to the legislative history, wasn't just to get rid of stale claims.
But that's a major purpose of a statute of repose.
But if you go to the Nelson report, if you go to the testimony before the legislature, there were several problems. One is the long tails that accompany these types of cases.
Okay, all right. All right. There aren't very many foreign objects cases. So if we allow foreign objects cases, which have been recognized as unique in other jurisdictions, I mean, that's not going to affect the health care crisis enough. If you want to weigh that element, there are just a handful of them. They're unique.
Well, again, there was testimony, Your Honor, with all deference to the legislature, that said, one, that having these long tails did affect insurance rates. Number two, doctors who were retiring, who would no longer buy coverage, could be liable for 10 or 15 years after they retired with no insurance and still have this exposure with no insurance then after the retirement, because the claim hadn't been brought for 10 years or 15 years. All that was addressed before the legislature in 2003 as part of the problem and part of the reason perhaps doctors didn't want to come to Texas and we had a shortage of doctors at that time.
But again, why wouldn't we carve out res ipsa cases as just a different animal, as other states, many other states have done, as to their statutes of repose?
With all due respect, because this is not the legislature, this is the court, and the question is whether or not our legislature had a reasonable basis to do what they did.
Did they have a reasonable basis for limitations under the Neagle, and do you think those cases were wrongly decided to say the open courts applies to prevent the application of the two-year statute?
Well, this gets into the factor, Your Honor, the second factor, and that is the effect, how broad of effect it is. And I'm going to answer your question. In the Owens case, the Owens court, this court said, well, we're not really affecting a lot of Texans. We're just affecting people in other states who come here to sue who are barred by their other states' statute of limitations. So it's very narrow. We also know, for example, that in the Trinity case versus URS, in footnote 6 of this court's opinion, this court said that only that 99.6%, according to a study, of all claims were brought within 10 years. So you had a very small segment of people being affected. The two-year statute, I think, being honest with the court, would affect a lot more people than are going to be affected by the 10-year statute of repose. And so there is going to be a larger group, a larger segment of the population. You have, more minors affected, and you have, obviously, and there was testimony, and I'll tell you where it is. If you go to the TAP amicus brief, page 20, there was statistics giving about what percentage of claims are brought within 3 years, what percentage brought, I think, within 6 years. And then it concluded that 99% of all the OBGYN claims were brought within 8 to 9 years of the time of the treatment. And so with respect to this case, this statute of repose here that we're dealing with, we know that within 8 to 9 years, 99% of all the claims that are going to be brought against OBGYNs, which typically are claims involving babies where there would be this long tail, are brought within the 8 to 9 years. So we have a very, very small segment or portion of the population that would be excluded by the statute that's being adopted by the legislature.
Which of the out-of-state cases that involve open court provisions are worded, which of those provisions are worded most similarly to ours, if you know offhand?
Well, we have a, we gave a listing in our brief, and I know the THR amicus brief had a listing as well. Obviously, I believe there were 13 of them, Your Honor, that had exceptions for foreign objects. Our legislature chose not to have exceptions for foreign objects, so obviously ours would not be within that group of 13. There were 21, however, that applied to all cases, even foreign object cases, and I think ours would be closer to those. I've got a table, I can read them to you, but they're in our brief there. They're also in the THR amicus brief. But that gets to the third factor that this court has looked at in determining whether or not the actions are reasonable, unreasonable, or arbitrary. And that is, if you go to the Owens Corning decision, I keep going back to that, this court says, we're going to do this, we're bringing Texas into the mainstream of other jurisdictions by this action. And apparently the thought process behind that was that if 30 or 40 or 45 other legislatures have adopted the same or similar legislation, how can you say that our legislation is unreasonable or arbitrary? In fact, in the Trinity case, this court noted that 46 other states had enacted analogous statutes of repose as part of their basis for this court's decision in the Trinity case, and we've supplied to the court what other jurisdictions have done. Again, 33 states and one territory have medical statutes of repose. 13 have exemptions for foreign objects. And the other thing that I think is very important is that no state in the United States has a statute of repose that's longer than Texas. We're tied for the longest statute of repose for medical negligence cases in the United States. There are some in other states that are as short as 3 years. But our legislature, and again, I think it shows the reasonableness of what our legislature did.
Do statutes of repose simply serve, in your mind, sort of a broader distinctive purpose than limitations statutes do?
It does. This court recognized it, I believe, in the Holdup case, where it said it's statute of repose is sort of the outside boundary, and it may operate to cut off cases and causes of action before they even arise, but it's for the purpose of giving manufacturers, of giving surveyors, of giving contractors knowledge that after a certain period of time, they don't have to be worried about suits from houses they constructed, products they sold, in this case, medical treatment that was rendered. And it's sort of the legislature conferring some peace of mind to these particular groups.
Why, if harping back to the argument in the last case, why wouldn't cutting off a claim before it even accrues raise an open court's bell?
Well, they believe that that is the test for open court's violations. It's not the test. Obviously, Judge Wainwright, every legislation that's passed probably is going to impact certain Texans positively and other Texans negatively. That's true, I think, with probably every statute that's been passed. But the question, again, is not whether or not, I was going to say you nine, but you eight justices would have done the same thing. That's not the test.
Because you're not, I'm curious about what the test is, though, because it looks a little like negotiation. The legislature starts out and says, okay, if you're under 6, you have to your 8th birthday. Then they say, well, if you're under 12, you have to your 14th birthday. Now they say 10 years no matter what. I get the feeling that we're sort of haggling.
Well, there obviously was a lot of discussion. There was a lot of testimony that was taken, trying to come up with a result that both sides of the aisle felt was fair. This was passed fairly overwhelmingly with support on both sides of the aisle as being something that was fair. And obviously is negotiation in all bills, Your Honor. I mean, it's probably ugly, but that's the way it happens.
The legislature can haggle and move its statutory targets. The Constitution should set up a principle, shouldn't it?
The Constitution has set up principles. And I think, Your Honor, the first principle is, as I started my argument, and that is, with the separation of powers, is that the legislature has a job to do. And they're equipped to do these jobs with committees where they can do fact-finding and fact-gathering and stuff that perhaps this separate body over here, the Supreme Court, doesn't have those ability to do. So the question is, did they do it in such a fashion that complies with this court's standards for open courts, the Constitution? That is, was it arbitrary and unreasonable? And I believe the evidence in this case shows that it was not.
Why do we need a... I'm sorry, go ahead. Is somebody else talking?
No, time's up.
Please, some feedback from the...
Why do we need a statute of repose if, in the previous case, we heard that the two-year statute is absolute, categorical, definitive? If that's true, then why do we need a 10-year outside boundary statute of repose?
I think if you look at the Nelson report, I think there's some question about whether or not the open courts accommodations for those causes of action that were inherently undiscoverable or impossible to discover would be carried over with this language. And the legislature was wanting to put a total outside limit to say, regardless of the open court's accommodations, regardless of the minority issues, as far as minors, 10 years is going to be the outside limit. And there's also, I think, if you read the legislative history, a difference, perceived difference in the way this court treats statutes of repose versus statutes of limitations.
Any further questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Teague will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, Emmeline Rankin, who is the respondent in this case, requests that this court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals and remand this case to the trial court for a trial. The other side has taken several positions in this case, and I have listed for you all of the steps, which I believe that are the seven elements. They have, in the essence, one or the other, has contested all but two of those issues. For example, they take the position that a medical negligence case is not a common law cause of action. I think this court has clearly and fairly recently decided that a medical negligence case, such as the case brought by Emmeline Rankin, is a common law, or was at common law, a common law cause of action. They also take the position that the application of the discovery rule to sponge cases was never well established. You've discussed Gaddis versus Smith several times this morning. Gaddis versus Smith is a Supreme Court case. There was no doubt left by Gaddis versus Smith as to whether the discovery rule was well established. In fact, in order to abolish the discovery rule, it took an act of the Texas legislature. There's never been even a hint that this court was going to itself abolish the discovery rule. In fact,
you think statutes of repose are constitutional in some contexts, like for architects or engineers?
I think in some contexts they are.
Why not this one?
I think in this case because the test was met by Emmeline Rankin, at least we're talking about summary judgment evidence. The test was that she, under the test, she did not have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong, her injury, and to bring suit.
Well, I'm sure there are some people that want to sue engineers and architects that didn't have a reasonable chance either, but it cuts across the board, doesn't it? That's the whole point of a repose is doesn't matter.
I think there's the distinction in the architecture and engineers cases that have been decided is that the statute of repose
already passed, 10 years passed before the injury occurred.
In this particular situation, the injury occurred at the same time the statute of repose began to run. Another distinction in between our case and the architects and engineers case is that in our case, we have no other person to sue. In the architects and engineers cases, those are normally premises liability cases.
Well, what if they weren't?
What if there were a plaintiff that had nobody but the engineer to sue?
Well, then it would be more difficult to distinguish the cases, I think, if there was no other person, for example, the premises owner occupier.
It seems to me that you're saying that there should be a different rule applied to personal injury claims versus property damage claims.
Not necessarily. I think there should be, though, a different rule applied to the category of foreign objects cases. I think that they are in a different category.
So how
they
are we
carve they are
out?
More difficult to discover.
How would you carve that out?
Well, I think I would carve it out under the test that this court has already established. The test of the constitutionality of the statute as applied is whether there has been a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong and bring suit. In this particular situation, I think that we have raised that fact issue. The fact issue is whether there has been a reasonable opportunity. I believe the summary judgment evidence clearly indicates that she did not. Emmeline Rankin did not have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong and bring suit. And in fact, that fact issue is not even contested by the defendants in this case. They have not argued against
it. The legislature say that you could give a period of time, say 25 years, 50 years, excuse the phrase, but as a matter of law, is enough time for a plaintiff to have a reasonable opportunity to discover. In other words, you know, through 50 years, you go for tests, and you're going to get x-rays at some point during that 50-year period, most likely. With modern science, you're more able to discover, you know, foreign objects, that sort of thing. I mean, is there a time period the legislature could have testimony from and say, this is enough time for the average person to discover a foreign object, and we're going to cut it off at this point so that these doctors can retire with peace of mind?
I think that's probably what the legislature intended to do. However,
why would
this,
that,
this court has decided there are two controlling decisions in this that this court should be guided by. One is in the Shaw versus Moss, which established the test of reasonable opportunity, and the second is that in Shaw versus Moss, this court decided that this is a fact issue. And so whether it's 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, up to 25 years.
Statute of repose case.
Excuse me?
Shaw versus Moss was statute of repose or limitation?
I believe that all of these cases are statute of repose cases because this court defines statute of repose in the Trinity River.
Shaw was statute of limitations, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's called a statute of limitations, but I think by definition under Trinity River Authority, both of these statutes, the two-year statute and the 10-year statute, are both really statutes of repose. I mean, you can call it a limitation statute, but it's still a statute of repose because it's not an accrual statute.
Is there a way for your client to prevail without declaring this statute unconstitutional?
Excuse me?
Is there a way for your client to prevail without declaring this statute unconstitutional?
I don't believe so. I believe that this case hinges on whether the statute as applied is unconstitutional. This is not a facial attack. This is an as applied attack. So I think that for her case to proceed, this court would have to hold that as applied, the statute violates her rights under the open courts provision.
I'm not sure I understand the concept of open courts as applied. It seems to me that the whole point of open courts is that you balance the regimen that has come along, like workers' comp, against all of the rights of the people involved, so that workers' comp trades a fault finding for limited benefits, in short, right? The employee doesn't have to show fault, but the employer's liability is limited. But there would be lots of employees who could easily show fault and lots of employers who could easily show that there was no fault. Yet we don't have an as-applied case saying, well, the Workers' Comp Act, as applied to this particular employee who can show clear fault, is not an open courts violation. Why is this different?
Let me see if I can start off by addressing it this way. Of course, there is a distinction between an as-applied attack and a facial attack. This is not a facial attack. This is an as-applied challenge or attack by one plaintiff, Emmeline Rankin, under the facts of this case. She is not trying to, she is not even trying to say that this case, that the statute is facially unconstitutional in all sponge cases. For example, there is distinction, I think, or difference in the factual situations in the earlier case, the Tangi Walters case, in this case, because there's been some discussion as to whether the symptoms were more recognizable in the Tangi Walters case. So, but this is an as-applied case.
So do you think that an employee who can show that his on-the-job injury was his employer's fault has an as-applied challenge to the Workers' Compensation Act under the open courts provision?
I don't take that position.
I'm asking you if he could do that.
I think that that gets back to the question of whether the benefits outweigh the balancing issue. I think the balancing there is that the employee has other rights. I should say, though, maybe this will be part of an answer here, is remember that under the workers' comp statute, the employee gets compensation, whereas under this case, if you rule in favor of the defendants, Emily Rankin gets no compensation.
But in any event, you think this is an as-applied
absolutely
challenge?
Absolutely. This is not a facial attack.
And the next question I have with that is there any other kind under a statute of repose? Because the people who sue in less than 10 years don't need to make one, and the people who sue in more than 10 years, that's all they have left. So is there anything other than an as-applied challenge to a statute of repose?
That may be the case, because I can't think of off the top of my head where you would have a facial attack.
Right.
I think that, let's say, use a wild, unreasonable circumstance. Let's say that the statute of limitation was a six-month statute of limitations. You might have a facial attack here, but this is a 10-year statute. And so I think under this circumstance, it has to be an as-applied attack.
Right. And the whole purpose of repose is to cut off no matter what. So basically, this undermines the purpose of repose.
I don't think it undermines the purpose of repose. This is, for number one, it's an as-applied challenge. Number two, as the Justice O'Neill, I think, has recognized, there are not many foreign object cases. This is not something that's going to happen every day, every minute. Number three, the purpose of the statute of repose is to bar stale claims. And this is not what is called a stale claim. This is a sponge case or a foreign object case is distinguished between those cases which you might refer to as stale claims. This case is one that is inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable, because we know when you take the sponge out of the subject and there's a earlier surgery, you add one and one and you get two there.
Well, but if you have like an architect's and engineer's statute of repose, I can see a situation where 12, 15 years after a building has been built, an inspection reveals some design defect that if they don't fix it, the building is going to fall down. Isn't that the same thing?
I don't think so. Because
it's a undiscoverable, latent, inherently undiscoverable problem, perhaps.
Okay. Here, I think though the distinction is that in the situation you just referred to, the statute of repose is already run by the time the injury occurs. So if it's a 10-year,
the defect has always been there.
Defect has always been there, but the statute of repose began to run at the end of construction and ran 10 years later, and then the accident and injury occurred, let's say, at 12 years later. So at that point, you get into the vested rights issue.
Well, I'm not even talking about an accident. I'm just talking about fixing it. Okay. When it's recognized, like you find the sponge later, the injury occurred back when the building was built, not when it fell down, because they fixed it before it fell down, but it still costs a lot of money to fix. Why wouldn't there be some open courts challenge there?
You might have an open court challenge there, but then you get into the you get into the vested rights issue there. And the question is whether the statute of repose has run before the injury occurred. And in all the situations that have been decided so far, the statute of repose in the architecture and architect and engineer cases has run before the injury occurs. So that's one of the distinctions between this case and those kind of cases. And I should say that in the Trinity River Authority case, this court didn't decide. I mean, it reserved some questions, and it reserved the question as to whether the person who was injured under other circumstances would have a open court's challenge to the statute of repose.
This court has said recently, as Justice Green sort of suggests, that injury happens when it happens, and not when somebody happens upon it, but when it happens, way back when, not when it's discovered 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
Okay, and maybe the distinction here is between an injury to the building owner because of a design defect and the injury to a person who suffers a personal injury because of a design defect. The Trinity River Authority case got into that issue, I think. But, I mean, there might be an open court challenge, but to me there are distinctions between those cases and this Sponge case. Maybe I'm
counsel,
not.
Counsel, let me ask this. The opposing counsel mentioned it. Other states have exceptions for Sponge cases and different types of cases. Surely the legislature undertook to consider those matters. I doubt if they just forgot about Sponge cases. And so we're really dealing with whether or not we're going to defer to the legislature to a certain extent here, are we not? And we're just going to have to say that they're wrong and that they that their judgment on this was just erroneous.
Well, I think it's just the opposite. I don't think this court defers to the legislature. I think the legislature defers to the court in this case. I think the legislature clearly decided not to accept Sponge cases or foreign object cases. There's no question about that. They could have done so, but decided not to do so. I think, in effect, the legislature left to this court to decide foreign object cases under the open court provision. The legislature had a choice. They could have either accepted them under the statute or left it up to the open court provision to be dealt with by the court. And I think that they decided not to accept them by the statute, but to leave for decision by this court on a case-by-case basis under the open court provision. I have a little more time left. Let me answer some of the questions that this court posed earlier. The chief asked whether the legislature abolished the discovery rule. Clearly, this court has held several times that the legislature abolished the discovery rule. So the challenge in this case is not under the discovery rule, it is under the open court provision.
How are they different, do you think?
How are they different? I think that they're related to each other. I think if you read all of the opinions of this court under open courts and discovery rule, there is a relationship between the two.
So that prompted my question. How do you think they're different?
One is the test under the open courts provision is whether there has been a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong or the injury and bring suit. And I would say that it would be almost splitting hairs to distinguish between the test under both. I mean, I think there is a similarity. And I think that this court's opinions bear that out. There is a question of whether the open courts provision should be categorically applied, and I think that this court could carve out categories for application of the open courts provision as it has done in the discovery rule cases. But certainly if this court decides to carve out open courts provision just to categories of cases, the foreign objects cases would be one of those categories to which the open courts provision should apply, just as The foreign objects cases are one of the, in fact, the first category of cases to which the discovery rule was applied.
How does that compare to your attack as applied to your client? You're talking about an individual situation versus carving out an entire group of citizens to...
I think that first you begin with the category of cases to which the open courts provision would apply, and then you go in, from there you go into the evidence, and you have to determine whether the evidence is such that the plaintiff did not have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong and bring suit. And I think that would be one of the ways you would distinguish the facts in this case to the facts in the Tangi Walters case. I mean, the discussion earlier, I think, would bear that out, that there may be some evidentiary differences between our case and the Tangi Walters case. So, broad category would be foreign objects cases, but the narrower category would be in which situation did a plaintiff have a reasonable opportunity to discover or not have a reasonable opportunity to discover, and I think the summary judgment evidence there would make those distinctions. In other words, there might be some foreign objects cases where there was a reasonable opportunity to discover within the either the 2-year or 10-year statute of repose.
Well, it seems to me, though, if the legislature wanted a carve out, they would have had a carve out, and for us to do otherwise would be exceeding our authority there to carve out a special section.
This, I don't think so, because, and maybe I'm going too far, but the test is whether there's a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong and bring suit. All I'm saying is, and when you apply that, or all I'm suggesting is that when you apply that test, it's more readily applied to a foreign object case than it is to, for example, a misdiagnosis case. The court has held in the Robinson versus Weaver case that the discovery rule didn't apply to misdiagnosis cases. I think you would probably reach the same conclusion in a open courts provision case.
Do you disagree with the analysis of other states' laws in the hospital's brief and the hospital amicus brief?
Other state laws or other courts' holdings?
Well, both statute.
Well, I think that they probably have summarized that there are some states that have an exception, some states that don't have an exception. That's true. I understand that. There are some courts that have upheld in as applied, and then there's some courts that have struck down laws as applied. So, but this court, in deciding open court provisions, has not yet decided the case under other courts' rulings. I mean, this court has decided it based upon its own rulings.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Teague.
What is your rebuttal?
Ms. Kineski will present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
May it please the court. We start with a basic premise that we think is posited by the respondent and is simply incorrect. Is there a reasonable opportunity to discover and bring suit? That might be a question that was applicable to the prior case involving limitations, but it's not applicable to this case involving the statute of repose.
Why?
Because the very purpose of the differing statutes.
So if it was 3 years, they wouldn't have the same strong argument that you have with 10 years.
I think the length of time goes to the weighing analysis, but it is just part of that underlying test. And returning to your concern earlier, we do have an awkward situation that Ms. Faust and I from the prior case had discussed at length between ourselves. It's an as-applied challenge, but its effect is a facial challenge, simply because of this tension between the questions we're forced to answer and properly applying the open courts analysis. The function of asking whether the statute is reasonable is not focused on the individual. It's focused on bigger public policy concerns that the legislature was free to take evidence on, to weigh, to decide for itself what was best for that particular point in time. It's particularly critical, I think, in the retained object context. In 1967, when this court adopted the discovery rule for those cases, there was a certain status of a medical technology that no longer exists. It was perfectly reasonable in a real-world context for the legislature to consider the changing role of technology, the changing role of medical care, and the crisis, not just insurance rates, Your Honors, but also access to health care. It was completely reasonable for the court to determine a 10-year statute of repose would address those issues. There is a direct connection between the crisis, the purpose of the statute, and what the legislature did.
They did that in both cases, in both the 2-year limitations case statute and the 10-year statute.
Exactly.
So should there be a reason to permit foreign object cases in statute of limitations claims or circumstances, but not in 10-year repose claims?
Yes.
And what would those be?
Well, I think part of your concern, Justice Green, harkens back to the question in the prior case. Is 2 years absolute in this context? Maybe it is, because we haven't had an opinion from this court specifically addressing Chapter 74. And I realize it's substantially similar to its predecessor. But it was also enacted as part of a whole scheme of attempts to bring some stability to the insurance and healthcare industry. It was part of a very long legislative process. Three times is the charm, is what I like to say. We don't have an opinion from this court that says 2 years is absolute. It might be appropriate to so hold in the other case. In this case, I don't think you need to decide that, because the purpose of a statute of repose is different from that of limitations.
And does that depend upon what the legislature names it? Because it seems to me that the statute of limitations that says the discovery rule doesn't apply is a statute of repose.
I think that's one of the concerns that the Fourth Court was struggling with. Both statutes are absolute in the terms of the Fourth Court. That is a concern. However, we do have some statutory guidance in this case. The Fourth Court, I think, glossed over the fact that a different provision of Chapter 74, 74051C, specifically describes 74251A as a statute of limitations. And then, of course, subpart B specifically says it is a statute of repose. It may be splitting hairs, but the legislature is trying to communicate to litigants and to the court that it intended something different by enacting those two provisions.
There are differences also, aren't they? I'm not sure if they're determinative here, but a statute of repose can cut off a claim before it even accrues, generally not
discovered
with the statute of limitations.
That's true.
Statute of repose begins to accrue at the time of the act giving rise to the injury. Statute of limitations may or may not accrue at that point in time.
True.
Are there other differences that might be material here between the two?
Let me just follow up on that. In light of the fact the legislature said the discovery rule doesn't apply to a statute of limitations, they blurred the distinction between the traditional statute of limitations and statute of repose. I mean, you said you're splitting hairs to try to find the difference in this context.
Exactly. Well, I think the legislature has struggled with the terminology in other cases as well. And Justice Wainwright, I believe you know that from the Pachuca Galbraith case. They very broadly characterize all the statutes in Chapter 16 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code as limitations periods. But some of them are clearly called statutes of repose within those particular subsections. And some of them operate much like the 2-year statute in healthcare liability claims, because they are absolute. They run from a certain date.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the Marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.